From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we explain the dark store loophole, which some businesses are using to decrease their property tax burden.
They can be significant because obviously these properties, whether it's a manufacturing plant or a large retail store, they can have significant amounts of property tax.
Then we'll talk with pianist Orly Shaham ahead of her performances with the MSO this weekend. She says classical music is still relevant to a broad modern audience.
It's a matter of making sure that people are exposed to it, and in particular that they're exposed to it in such a way that they know that it's there for them, that it's not somebody else's music, but it is something that will be heard and be effective specifically for them.
And we'll have the latest episodes of Radio Chipstone and our storytelling series, Exfabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier this month, the city of Wauwatosa was featured in a New York Times article, but instead of the flyover country narratives we've become used to here in Wisconsin, the piece focused on a new tax avoidance tactic that has some municipalities worried. It's called the dark store loophole, and it's become a popular tool for businesses looking to decrease their tax burden in the Badger State.
Jason Stein is the director of research at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which has been researching the impact of this tax avoidance tactic. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and began by explaining the mechanics of the dark store loophole.
Well, this all comes back to how businesses are assessed for billing for property tax purposes. And so-called dark store challenges are appeals that retailers or other businesses are making in which they're arguing that their assessments, their property tax assessments, should take into account the values of similar properties that are now vacant or dark. And that's how you get that term.
Now, what is the argument for that? Because I think anyone looking at that really on the face of it, they go, well, one store has been vacant for quite a while and the other one is doing business every day. Why would we assess them in the same way?
Sure. The argument on the part of the retailers, and to be clear, our organization hasn't taken a position on this one way or the other. We're a nonpartisan organization. But to explain the argument of the retailers, they are arguing that in the marketplace, the real estate marketplace, if you have some stores that are vacant, that is an indication of what the value of such a property would be. If it didn't have a tenant in it, a viable tenant in it, and that should be at least in part factored in when a municipality goes to assess the value of a piece of property for the purposes of levying the property tax.
Okay. How is the value of a property generally determined?
Well, there's three main approaches in Wisconsin. There is the sales approach, which looks at what buyers have paid for other comparable properties. There is the cost approach, which focuses on how much does it cost to build a property minus any depreciation that would have happened in the intervening years. And then there is the income approach that looks at how much income does a property generate. So, for example, an apartment building with high rents would be assessed more under that approach than a building with very low rents.
So I think this kind of gets to the heart of who is making these appeals. What are the businesses who are generally making these appeals in the state of Wisconsin? Because it does seem pretty unique to big box stores.
Certainly big box retailers are one of the groups that have, you know, made a significant use of this type of appeal. But it is not strictly limited to big box retailers. So you have seen some use of it, for example, something comparable done by manufacturers. manufacturers also happen to be one class of property that is assessed by the state government rather than by local city or other municipal governments. And again, they have made a similar argument in which they say, well, you should be factoring in how much this factory would fetch on the market if it were vacant. And obviously the argument on the other side, which I haven't given until now, is no, a store that is vacant, a factory that is vacant, is not comparable, the advocates on the other side say, to a store that is filled and doing a brisk business, or a factory that is filled and churning out widgets and making a profit on a daily basis.
Yeah, so the argument on one side is essentially these are specialized stores. They aren't going to get maybe the best price on the market, in part because they would have to be changed so drastically. But yes, the other side of the argument is that, well, it's not a vacant property. So that, you know, this is kind of a hypothetical.
Right. Right. I think that's a fair summary of the debate and the controversy.
So this was actually featured recently in the New York Times. It highlighted specifically Wauwatosa. And it seems like they used kind of Wauwatosa as a way of talking about the issue more deeply. But what is happening in places like Wauwatosa, like these other Wisconsin towns that have a lot of big box stores, have a lot of that kind of industry, who might be making these appeals?
Sure. Well, again, for a corporation, if they see that some competitors or other people within the groups within the marketplace are making this argument, then you know they're going to consider it because they have a responsibility to shareholders. And so if they see an opportunity to increase their margins or lower their taxes, they're obviously going to look at it. As far as you know what's happening in the marketplace, I think you know, part of what we're discussing here is obviously we live in a global marketplace. We have seen the rise of internet retailers over in recent years. And obviously there are dislocations in the market, there are changes. And so, you know, one question is, I think that underlays this whole debate is what will be happening with brick and mortar retailers in future years. And, you know, that may be in part both the concern on the part of municipal governments, as well as perhaps some of the urgency on the part of traditional retailers who want to be as competitive as possible.
Yeah. But what does it mean for taxpayers in a given municipality? I mean, you mentioned, of course, manufacturers. A lot of that goes into the state of Wisconsin as opposed to a city or county. But when it comes to municipalities who are taking in these tax dollars, what does it mean when their taxes are decreased pretty significantly in some cases?
Right. That, I'm glad you asked that question because that's a part of this that we hadn't talked about. Obviously, there's still, in the greater scheme of things, a relatively small number of dark store appeals, but they can be significant because obviously these properties, whether it's a manufacturing plant or a large retail store, they can have significant amounts of property tax. If they successfully appeal and get their property tax assessment and their property tax bill lowered, then the municipality has got to decide, do they just simply forego those revenues with a potential impact on services, or do they spread that tax bill, that those lost taxes onto other property owners in the same jurisdiction? And so what you can potentially have is a situation where the taxes on a retail store go down, and then they go up on homeowners and other businesses in that same city or that same jurisdiction.
I mean, one of the things that the New York Times piece pointed out was just how significant the increase to individual homeowners, individual taxpayers, can be, as much as, you know, $300 in one case of increased taxes as a result of a manufacturer, I believe, in that case, making this appeal, getting their taxes lowered. How much are we seeing these kinds of tax challenges around the state of Wisconsin, and what kind of impact is it already having on taxpayers?
Sure. So I can speak to that. It's really going to vary on a community-by-community basis, right? So if you had a modest-sized retailer in a large city like, say, Milwaukee or Madison, and they successfully appeal and get their assessment lowered, you know, the individual impact on a given home or other business may not be noticeable, right? I mean, it may be a relatively minimal impact. On the other hand, if you have a small community, and let's say they have an anchor manufacturing plant, and that anchor manufacturing plant gets its assessment lowered by a significant amount, okay, in that situation, yes, you could have, you know, a $50 increase on a home, or even an increase into the hundreds of dollars on a home. And so it's really on a case-by-case basis. And part of the, you know, what it comes down to is how big is that business when it's compared to the overall property tax base in that community? And it's just going to vary.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I know this is an issue that lawmakers have been at least talking about. How are they addressing the issue? Is there any pending legislation on these kinds of dark store loopholes, as they're often referred to?
Sure. Well, there's a Legislative Council Study Committee that looked at the issue. They made some recommendations related to property tax assessments. I have not looked at those recommendations in any depth. Some of the people involved in the debate have argued that those recommendations would not significantly alter the kinds of disputes or issues that we've just talked about. I think clearly there were strong efforts both to change and to preserve the status quo in the past legislative session. None of that is going to go away. You're going to see a debate over this issue, a very vigorous debate over this issue in the next legislative session that has just begun. And we're going to have to see what the outcome of that is. Obviously, Republican legislative leaders have been reluctant to make changes. Governor Evers and some lawmakers of both parties have argued for making changes. And we're just going to have to see how that all plays out.
Jason Stein is the director of research at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find a link to some of their research on the dark store loophole at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now and then talk with pianist Orly Shaham ahead of her performances this weekend with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Pianist Orly Shaham returns to Milwaukee this weekend after a three-year absence, but the piece she'll perform, Béla Bartók's Piano Concerto No. 3, is the same one that brought her here in 2016. It is a piece that was written at the end of Bartók's life and is romantic in a way that a lot of Bartók isn't.
We reached Shaham by Skype to learn more about the concerto and about the joys of making music in our electronic age. Orly Shaham, thanks so much for joining us today.
No, thanks for having me. I'm excited to come back to Milwaukee, although, you know, whenever I tell people Milwaukee in January, they look at me like maybe I made a mistake.
We're so thrilled to have you back to play the Bartók Third. And this piece, I just was listening to it this morning to refresh my memory. It had been a while since I'd listened to it. And it is so melodic. It is not what a lot of people think of when they think of Bartók.
No, and I think, you know, one of the things that draws me always to this piece. This was a very late piece, in fact, one of his very last pieces. And he knew that this was the end of his life. And it has a quality to it, which I think certain creators, writers and composers get near the end of their life, where really there's an economy of means. There's an ability to express so much with so little in a way that is so powerful. And this piece is very much, it's distilled down to its essences. There are not too many notes thrown at you. It's very clean lines, almost Mozartian in the way that he handles both the piano and the orchestra. And yet it is just so emotive and so emotional. It's filled with all sorts of energy that touches every part of you in such a clear, clean way.
It was a gift, wasn't it? Wasn't it a gift for his wife?
It was a gift for his wife. You know, he knew that his life was ending, and he actually wrote it for her and for her to play, in part because he was worried that she would need a source of income after he died, and he wanted her to have this piece to play. And not surprisingly, in the world of the 1940s, she was hardly the one who played it the most. She wasn't even the one who ended up playing it first. It was, of course, a man who did that.
Did she end up earning money from it?
Some, but I think nowhere near what he had hoped would happen.
Well, you mentioned Mozart. The piece is so melodic. And yes, Bartok was always using Hungarian folk tunes in a lot of his orchestral works and other pieces and his other piano pieces. But there's something about this that is incredibly lush and melodic. There's a little atonality, but not a lot. And it's so, what's the word I want? It lets you in so easily.
Absolutely. I feel like, you know, the first movement, it's really like a folktale. So in the sense of not necessarily even using Hungarian themes, although there are some musical ideas that way, it takes you in as if somebody is telling you a folk story. And the piano begins right at the beginning in octaves, sort of explaining this story, letting you in, setting the scene. It's quite dramatic in that way. And of course, Bartok had written dramatically many times for ballets and for other theatrical settings. So there is that feeling in the first movement, I feel like throughout, and a beautiful dialogue between the piano and the orchestra, some really well thought out orchestration, where there's, you know, just enough color coming from the orchestra without ever being overwhelming to what the piano's doing. Yeah. And the second movement is this gorgeous, gorgeous prayer. It's clearly somebody writing at the end of their lives, but it's so personal and intimate. It sounds like one person trying to speak to the universe. Really stunning.
I agree with you that there is that sort of sense of longing and reaching in that second movement. And it's just sort of sink into it.
Yeah. And, you know, in the middle of the second movement, there's a central section, which is very typical Bartok, what he and others refer to as night music, the kind of the sounds you hear of maybe animals, things that might be moving around in the night. Quite beautiful, bringing everything back into the natural world.
This is the second time that you've returned to Milwaukee to play the same concerto. Is that an unusual thing?
It is, actually. You know, the piano repertoire is so huge, and I play fairly regularly about 40 different concertos. So it's unusual for me to come back and play the same piece, but it'll be with a different conductor this time. And I had such a great pleasure last time working with the orchestra on this. I'm really looking forward to hearing them again and collaborating with them again on it.
When you approach a piece that you've played before, and most soloists will play the same pieces more than once in their careers, they'll play them often, but how do you approach it again? How do you keep it fresh for yourself?
You know, for me, a piece like this is so rich. I feel very lucky to be able to explore it again and again. Every time I come back to it, I find new and surprising things, you know, connections where I think, how did I not see that before? And this is the great thing about playing the kind of music that I do. You know, there is such richness there. There are so many layers you can peel off so much of this onion that it provides a lifetime's work. You never get the feeling that you're coming back and, oh, not this again. You know, there's always more to be found in it.
Well, and you mentioned a different conductor. And of course, the orchestra will have changed, too. There are some new players. People have retired. And so even though the sound might be very similar, it's not going to be exactly the same.
It never is. And I, even from one performance to the next, you know, when we do two or three performances on a weekend, they're really not the same performance. There's something about the particular day and where the musicians have been and especially that particular audience and the kind of listening that you get back from the audience. It really does impact how you play. This is what makes live performance so exciting to me. You know, recording has many virtues, and I enjoy recording very much, but it doesn't have that feeling of, you know, this is being created at the moment, and whatever happens, happens.
Well, you talked about the quality of listening, and there's a lot of talk these days about how people in our world don't have the ability to sit quietly and listen anymore. We're so distracted by our electronic gizmos and other things pulling at us. Do you find that to be true once you get into the concert hall and you actually have an audience there?
You know, that's a great question. I feel that the concert hall is one of the few havens we have from that sort of thing at the moment, because there is an understanding that we all turn off our phones, we're not going to look at them, and it may take some people a little longer, other people less time, but everybody eventually gets sucked in. I had a great experience just a few days ago in Los Angeles. I was playing as part of my shows that I do for kids. Then I played a Mozart sonata for a group of kids, you know, between the ages of maybe 2 and 12 and their parents and grandparents. And in about 10 seconds of starting this Mozart sonata, they were all completely engrossed. And that experience it happens time and time again. That kind of deep focus that you do in the listening is so satisfying.
Well, it's really gratifying to hear that young children, who everyone is so worried about, you know, being sucked into the phones, that they're the ones who are like just rapt when you are playing. I mean, that's very heartening.
Well, you know, it says what I think we've always known, which is this music is great. There's no issues with the quality of what it is that we're doing. And it's really a matter of making sure that people are exposed to it, and in particular, that they're exposed to it in such a way that they know that it's there for them, that it's not somebody else's music, but it is something that will be heard and be effective specifically for them.
Do you think that orchestras and, well, musicians specifically, but also organizations, whether it's chamber music or orchestral, are people and organizations doing that better? Are they reaching out? Because classical music always had a reputation of being somewhat elitist. Whether you agreed with it or not, that was sort of the popular culture idea about it. I've never felt that way, but I know a lot of people who do.
I don't think elite is a bad word. I think it's good, actually, to do something at the height of how you can do that thing. But to be elitist is the problem, right? Is to say, well, I have this thing and you can't have it. And I do feel that classical music has changed very much from that. There's a feeling now of there's so many people out there who you can reach and who amazingly want to be reached. It's really just a question of getting the music in the right places and in the right ways for them to access.
Yeah, and it's more than just taking the orchestra out of formal clothing. You know, there's other ways of engaging people where they are.
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of it has to do with sort of concert hall etiquette and being able to give people access points, talking about the music in a way that somebody who may feel that they didn't have the right training nevertheless feels that they can come into it in some way. It varies from audience to audience. It varies from hall to hall and from organization to organization. The issue is across the board, and I think not just in this country, but really around the world. But the answers, the solutions are site-specific and they are organization-specific. And it has to do, we are communication from people to people. And in the end, individuals make up those groups of people, and you have to figure out what works best.
One of the ways you've done that, in addition to your playing, is that you've been on the side of the microphone where I am, and you've done things for NPR. How does reaching that kind of an audience help you get into the concert hall? Or once you get into the concert hall?
I think that people who listen to the radio and so who are already attuned to the idea of getting information primarily through your ears are sort of the perfect fit for us, right? This is what we're all about. There's some interesting visual things happening when you come to a concert, but the main thing that is so unique and so different from your everyday life is the incredible things that come through sound.
Yeah. A friend years ago when I was first getting into radio called it brain to brain and heart to heart.
It's that, very lovely.
That direct Absolutely. Connection. You know, you kind of bypass all the intellect in some ways, and you just get right to the meat of it.
Well, and the other thing that I love about this kind of concert, and this is true really for most types of live events, is here we are on stage and we're communicating with the audience as a whole, but each individual member of that audience is having their own unique experience, which is absolutely true and complete. And it's somehow the fact that all these individuals having those experiences at the same time heightens that experience for all of us, you know, for the performers as well as the listeners.
There's something about, I think, seeing, you know, that wide-eyed sense or feeling that wide-eyed sense of wonder when you're touched, whether you're a little kid or whether you're an old person, it doesn't matter, of just being touched in that way.
And I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, with music, it often surprises us. You know, we think as species, we tend to think linguistically, and we tend to think that it's all about things we can verbalize. Suddenly, there are these things that touch us in a completely different way that we couldn't even put words to if we tried, that gets to a part of our humanity we may not reach quite as often.
Or maybe any other way. Well, we are so looking forward to having you back. It's been 3 years. It'll be nice to have you back on stage with the Milwaukee Symphony, Orly. And I thank you so much for taking a little time to talk with us today about music, about Bar Talk, and just about the joy of making music.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm excited to come back.
Pianist Orly Shaham performs Béla Bartók's Piano Concerto No. 3 with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra this weekend. You'll find more information at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break, and then Radio Chipstone goes in search of the perfect fit. We'll learn more when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
It's Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The end of January is a bit late to talk about resolutions, but contributor Jennifer Fields has finally made one she's able to keep. Her resolution, find a bra that fits. For the approximately 50% of the population who do not wear them, this search might seem like a silly thing. But for those who do wear them, the struggle to find something barely tolerable, let alone comfortable and supportive, is real.
According to MarketWatch, foundation wear is a $12.4 billion industry and growing. Trillian Bergman and Meredith Northway are in the business of helping those who need the support find something that fits. In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Bergman and Northway hope to help the bra-wearing community make peace with the devil.
So what you really want to have holding the breast tissue in place is actually the band, so the part that goes around your rib cage. To have that part be supportive, it needs to be tight enough that it's going to do about 80 to 85% of the work for the bra so that you don't rely on the straps. A lot of women find that the straps, they're cranking them really tight to hold up the weight of their breast, but if you have a band that's tight enough, you won't have to do that and you shouldn't really feel anything on your shoulders.
Are there basic components, Trillian, that just have not changed? What makes up a bra?
So the thing that makes a bra is basically just the band and the cup. Beyond that, you don't have to have a wire, you don't have to have straps, but it's just having the band tight enough where it stays in place, provides support from the core of you rather than coming from the top. And then the cup needs to be basically structured enough that it provides support within the cup itself. So things like molding or seams provide uplift, as well as keeping them on your chest, keeping the bra on your chest with the band. And then straps, obviously, they provide a lot of stabilization, but they don't provide much support, as Meredith said, just that 15%. And then wires are another option for more structure and support.
So the basic concept, the basic structure of the bra hasn't changed.
No, I think it's true, but it feels like a myth a little bit of like the inception of the actual bra as we know it today, where it's just like two handkerchiefs and a ribbon. Like that's the idea of where it came from. And that basically hasn't changed. You'll find a lot of bralettes are basically the same thing, where they're just two little triangles of fabric and a band that goes around. It's basically a ribbon.
So, Meredith, while the structure, the basic structure of the bra hasn't changed, two handkerchiefs and a ribbon, as Trillian said, while that hasn't changed, the aesthetic, the style, the look has certainly shifted over the years.
Absolutely. And especially in recent years, it's become, you know, your lingerie can be a trendy part of your outfit, too. And it's not just something that you wear that's not ever seen. It's really funny looking back, seeing over the year how styles have changed. You know, we went through bullet bras and fun things like that. And now the market tends to be more saturated, at least in America, with, you know, bras that have more padding and molding, very round shape. Nothing's going to show through. But it even varies country to country. A lot of the brands that we carry are not from the United States, and they like to focus on lace and really beautiful designs and have a more natural shape.
So is there a choice then, Trillian, since you deal with inventory, do we have to make a choice between what is considered beautiful and what's considered supportive?
Of course we can. The whole point of the lace and the beauty is that they provide a lot more structure. So a lot of the bras that we're used to in the U.S. are that more padded, molded, beige, kind of blah-looking bras. And those actually don't provide very much support and because there's not very much structure in the cup. Even though you're used to seeing them, looking at them and seeing them, that they're like already a shape, they don't tend to fit very well because they don't allow for any difference in size from each side. And each woman is a different shape. And if you're not that same shape, then they don't fit very well. So the nice thing about the lace is that they are a little bit more flexible in the cup and they provide a little bit more unique fit. And they have a lot more lift to them also. So if you're wanting lift and separate, really what you should be looking at is a lace bra.
So pretty. Mm-hmm. Pretty things do hard work.
Yes, they do. And comfortable to boot.
So as someone who's in the business of making women comfortable in this foundation wear, I've read studies that say that they're not necessary for our physical health, right? Whether or not that's true, who knows? You can read studies on both sides. Some say that it's important to wear. Some say not so much. Follow the money. That'll tell you what side they stand on. But I'm wondering if it's not only a physiological thing, but it's an emotional thing. It's a mental thing. Like having something that fits you well and supports you is more about how I feel internally than not how I look externally, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that just even from my personal experience, coming here and trying on things that fit so perfectly is just a huge confidence boost. We're used to going to the stores and just grabbing things that look like they're close and will work, trying them on, wrestling them on and off of our own bodies, not being sure if anything fits exactly how it should. And, you know, it can be kind of a negative experience trying on undergarments by yourself.
What are the common mistakes people make? What mistakes do we make when we're purchasing foundation wear?
With bras specifically, I think the biggest mistake, and it's not the consumer's fault at all, is that at most, you know, typical stores in America, we only go up to a triple D or an F cup that's available, and that's just not realistic. So what stores will do is put you in a band size that's way too large and not secure to your body to get your breasts covered. So, you know, maybe you need a 32H or something, and they put you in a 38 triple D. The biggest thing I see is people coming in who have been wearing a band size that's far too large just to get the right cup size, and then they're not experiencing the right amount of support coming from the band.
Coming here is one thing, but if you can't get here, what's a good way to make your best guess at what you need?
I would say if you can measure around your body, just underneath your breast tissue on your rib cage, we say if you measure at an even number, add 2 or 4 to that number to get your band size, generally 2. But if you feel like things are just really too tight, 4 is fine. If you measure at an odd number, 1 or 3 added to that number will get you the correct band size. From that, cups are really mostly based on how wide the wire is, or just how wide the cup is if it's not wired. So if you have something already at home, figure out where that band needs to be, and from there, see, would it be better if it was 1 finger over, 2 fingers over? See if you can find out where that wire should rest so that all of your breast tissue is contained. And then that, however many like finger widths along that is, that should be about how many cup sizes up from that or down. It's a lot easier to size too big than too small. So if you're finding that the wire or the edge of the cup is really in your armpit, that's telling you that the cup is actually too big.
So that's a lot.
It's science, Trillian. It really is science, which is why it's so easy to go that one. You know what I mean? It, it becomes this thing where, for the most part, until it starts to hurt, it's innocuous. Mm-hmm. It's a reflex action. It's what I do. It's part of my morning routine. Mm-hmm. It's something that I grab. And honestly, I calculate how long I'm going to be out, what I'm going to be doing, and then I pick the one that I think is going to annoy me the least amount of my day.
Yeah, and I think that's a common thing, but it really is having the right size bra means that you just forget that you have it on. And forgetting this thing that takes up so much energy gives you so much more mental energy and space to actually do things outside of the house and outside of your job and all of these things. So it's really, I mean, that's why we're here. That's why we do this. It's an empowering moment when you just do not have to do the extra work in your head that an ill-fitting bra is taking up.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Jennifer spoke with Trillian Bergman and Meredith Northway of La Lingerie in Madison.
We will take one last break and then return with our storytelling series, Exfabula. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True personal stories.
Exfabula! Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And welcome back to another edition of Exfabula Radio and Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, joined by Exfabula's Desiree Constantino. Welcome back.
Well, thanks, Rachel. And well, as we come to a close of January, we are looking at our first public storytelling workshop of 2019 coming up next weekend on February 2nd. So that's kind of exciting. If anybody's got the tell a story goal for 2019, this would be a great time. time to head over to xfabula.org and sign up. With that in mind, this week our theme is Practice Makes Perfect, starting off with a story from Jim Winship and our Acquired Taste Story Slam from March of 2017.
When I was 12 years old, I never could have imagined getting up in front of a group of people and saying anything. You know, I was shy, I was awkward, so skinny I was almost two-dimensional. You know, just all knees and elbows and glasses thick enough to stop a 7-inch artillery shell. Now, in my adult life, I've spent a lot of time talking in front of groups of people, but most of those have been as a college professor. In a college classroom, there's a predictable, polite response. You're the one giving the grades, and it's not a tough crowd. But when you get up on stage at a story slam, it's different. You know, one, the stories are personal, and then there's the timekeeper. The timekeeper. You can really bomb up here. I mean, I went to a story slam, an ex-fabulous story slam a few years ago. I think it was in Walker's Point. I thought about coming in, but I had a really busy week. And just at the last minute, I thought, okay, I'll take the hour drive to come in here. And I sort of had a half-baked story in my head. But as I drove, it seemed to come together. And so when I got in, I put my name in the hat, and I got picked. And so I got up on stage. And halfway through, I knew it wasn't working, and it wasn't going to work. And that idea for an ending that seemed so good when I was driving in, I could barely remember it. And at that point, I was really hoping that the rapture would come. And so all those people sitting in the bar would rise up to heaven, and they wouldn't have to hear the rest of my story. Or maybe the four horsemen of the apocalypse would bust in, you know, war and death and pestilence and the other guy, and everyone would forget that I was on stage. There was another time, and this was only about a year or so ago. It was an ex-fabulous story slam, and the theme was something that fit really well, because my wife and I had been in Colombia, and we had gotten lost in the Amazon jungle. So I was ready, and I came in and got picked, and I was on stage. The problem was it was a complicated story. It's actually harder to get lost in the jungle than you would think. So I'm on stage and going through that, and the timekeeper, and she seemed really nice before I started, but she was flipping up those cards, you know, halfway, 1 minute, you know, and I was racing to get through. I mean, this Southern boy was talking as fast he's ever talked in his life. I was talking over laughter, and it still didn't work. It still didn't work. But there are times, you know, when you get to be on stage, and the crowd and that kind of half buzz that comes with story slams, they kind of sense that maybe the story is going somewhere, that maybe we'll pay some attention, and the person who's telling, they're not going to get lost, right? It's not going to be one of those times when somebody gets up and says, I've never told this story to anybody before, and if my therapist knew I was doing this, she probably wouldn't be happy. No, when the story is going, it's like everybody's, you know, on a ride together. And as you're going and you're coasting toward the end, and the timekeeper doesn't really look like the spawn of Satan and is not doing that. And in that moment, you know, there's no place I'd rather be. So you can call it an acquired taste. You can call it an addiction. I'm just glad I'm up here.
And that was Jim Winship, and he's one of our most prolific storytellers. He's just got that soothing voice that just makes you go, ah, you can tell that he was a professor. He's truly a storyteller, even though he says that he really had to work himself into it. Our next story comes from a high school student, Nolan Eggleston. And Nolan was a workshop participant, actually. We had a student workshop at South Milwaukee High School, and he was one of the students that we chose. And if you listen to him tell this story, you can see why. He's really a funny kid, and he stood out. This is his Risking It story from the curated Story Slam, a special event, South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center in November of 2017.
Hi, everybody. I'm Nolan, obviously. And when I was a sophomore, this was last year, I was looking for a class that would give me an easy A. I needed to boost my GPA because, let me just say, my freshman year wasn't so hot for me. I was thinking my freshman year, oh, I don't want to go to college. I don't know. Like, I'm a little kid, you know what I mean? I'm still like 13 years old at this point. So I don't want to go to college. I don't know what I want to do, so I flunked. Freshman year, I had like D's and C's. I didn't fail any classes. That's good. But I needed a big GPA booster my sophomore year. So my friends were saying, hey, let's take, because they were in the same boat as me, they were saying, let's take some art class. Art classes are easy, right? You guys take art classes before in high school? There you go, there's one right there. Let me just say, you art majors, you art class takers, I have mad respect for you guys. Those are not that easy, but we'll get to that in the future. So I'm telling my mom, right, before I get to this class, I'm telling her, hey, mom, my GPA is going to be way better this year. Like, don't worry about freshman year. That didn't even happen. So first day of class, right, I show up. I have a couple friends in this class as well. So I'm like, this is going to be amazing. I'm going to have a blast in this class, breeze through sophomore year. And it's my third class of the day, first term. So it's still in the morning, not really, whatever. So we get our first project a couple days in after we're warmed up to the teacher. And it's a cartoon strip. I have to make a cartoon of some animated object moving across its life. And I had Miss Culp, I still remember this. Mrs. Culp, if you're here right now, I'm sorry. So I had to make an animated object moving across its life. And my whole life I was told I was a pretty creative person with my mind and not really my hand. So I'm making this strip, and everybody else's looks kind of like mine. We're still like little kids drawing, right? We're 13, 14 years old. How good can it be? Miss Culp held us to really high standards, apparently. So I'm doing my project, and I turn it in. And she said, is this it? Are you done? Or are you just asking me if it's good or not? And I was like, I'm done, of course. Why would I hand it in? And she says, it's definitely not done, Nolan. Go take it back and try again. At this point, okay, Ms. Culp, thank you for that boost in my ego, right? So I go back to my table. We have tables and we have partners, but not on the projects, just to talk to. So I go back and I'm talking to my partner, and they tell me a couple things I could add to make it a little better. So I add these things and I turn it in. I'm like, okay, this is actually pretty good. It looks a lot better than everybody else's. So that's my opinion. So I get it back a few days later, and I get a C. I get a C on the class that I thought was gonna boost my GPA. That did not boost my GPA, let me tell you. So I get over it. I don't wanna show my mom because I tell her, oh, this is an easy class, and if I get a C, what's she gonna say about that? So I tell her I lost my project. It disappeared into thin air. I don't know if you believe in magic, you guys, but I promise you, it disappeared. So we do these things called like interpretations of images. I mean, I don't know what it's actually called, but so there's an image on the board and we have to describe what it is in our mind. So these are supposed to boost our grade if we don't do super good, because they're supposed to be pretty easy. And I do pretty good on these. We did two of them in between. We had two big projects that term. And I do pretty good on these. I get B's on these. So I think, okay, now I have a B in the class. So maybe I can get an A, boost my GPA to a 4.0, right? Let's just say the next project was a self-portrait. Yeah. So I'm glad I started in pencil first because it was colored. So I'm using my pencil and I'm trying to make my appearance a lot better than it actually is, right? Like, who wouldn't do that? So I'm drawing myself and I get towards the end and I'm like, wow, I hold it up and I'm in the mirror and I go, this looks nothing like me. Like, this whole time I'm thinking, oh, this is gonna be great. Like, I'm gonna make myself look great and I'm gonna get an A, right? Of course. So at this point I have a B in the class as well. So if I get an A on this, I might have to boot, it might go to an A, and that'll be the end of the term. There's my easy A that I was talking about. I'm doing my project, Ms. Culp so far is saying, oh, it's great, Nolan. Good job, like boosting my confidence for real this time. So then I get towards the end of it, and it's actually coming together. Like, I fix a bunch of things, and my eyes are circles now. And so it's pretty good. And she taught us these things with the pupils where they're like in more, and it, I don't know, it made me look a lot better. So I'm coming up and I turn it in, and she takes it the first time this time. And I go home and I tell my mom right away, hey, Mom, I might get an A in this class that I told you I was going to get an A in. Because at this point, she wasn't believing me, though, since the beginning, right? Because I got a C on the first project. So now she's maybe Nolan, maybe you will get an A. So a couple days go past, she's grading them, and I can just picture her. I can picture her looking at my thing like she looked at the other one, upside down, sideways, trying to find out, looking at my school picture, does it look like him, does it not? So I get it back a couple days later. Can you guys guess what I get on it? Yep, there you go, nope, not an A, another C. Yeah, there it is, right? So I get it back, and I'm looking at all my friends. They get A's. They have A's in this class. Like, they're definitely going to make fun of me. I don't want to show them. I flip it over, right? And my friend who sits next to me, he flips it back over. And I'm like, okay, just touch my stuff, I guess. So he flips it over, and he sees a big red C in the top corner. And he looks at me, and he just starts laughing. And everybody's now looking at us because the class is quiet. Like, so everybody's looking, and he says, oh, he got a C. And everybody says, oh, like nobody cares, you know what I mean? So my one friend who told me to take the class starts making fun of me, of course. And so I didn't pass the class with an A like everybody said I would, and I passed the class with a C, unfortunately. But I took a risk for sure, because I could have dropped this class. I could have been right when I got the C, or I can drop it and take an online class and get an A. But like, who wants to do that? It's an art class. If you drop an art class, I mean, no offense, come on. Like, it's an art class. So that's when I say I have mad respect for all of you art majors, all you art class takers. Ms. Culp, I don't know if you're here, probably not, no worries. I have respect for you, so thank you guys.
And that was Nolan Eggleston from November 2017. And I gotta admit, you know, I'm proud of the kid for hanging in there and not dropping the class so he didn't lower his grade point average. Cause, you know, I think a lot of kids, especially with the pressure these days to keep their grade point up, would have maybe taken the road most traveled at this point.
That's a good way to reinforce the year in that spirit of New Year's resolutions.
That is very true. Now, coming up for us, our February Story Slam is on the 20th, and that's going to be damaged goods. I guess that could be a whole lot of things, you know? So it's up for wide interpretation. And you can find out about that and all other XFabula-related events at xfabula.org.
Well, practice makes perfect when it comes to XFabula's storytelling.
Oh, so most definitely.
Thanks again for coming in, Desiree. We look forward to seeing you again next week.
Thanks, Rachel, and take care of yourself.
XFabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. Coming up next, it is 4 o'clock.